I have a couple of goals this afternoon. First is to say some few things about what the project is that I direct in Los Angeles, and then to go into something of a critique of roadblocks that have been put up in the path of research on cuneiform of the last 10 or 12 years by some organizations who are opposed to the treatment of so-called unprovenienced tablets. And then having said that, then I want to have a look at one of, I think, the major, let us say, one of two really major new private collections that have been made available for research in the past 20 years. The one that I have been most affiliated with is the Skirring Collection in Oslo. And we have David Owen here, who is the director of a project to edit the second, that is the Cornell Collection in Ithaca. Well, I put up first, I thought I'd like to show you what I think all Assyriologists ought to have given sufficient resources. That is the CDL iPhone that would you would take into a museum with you, and that would give you immediate access to all of the images of the tablets you're about to see in that museum, and would also allow you to call home to order up the dinner that you're having that evening. The CDLI has as its primary goal really just one thing. That is that we want to establish permanent pathways for digital copies of cuneiform inscriptions. And the importance of permanent pathways is one of a new pathway for research. Namely, that I think we all know that we are starting to leave the tradition of standardized paper publications, and that we can do more and more effectively if we can transfer the communications from paper to an electronic media. One of the things that is holding that up is the fear that I think all of us have of so-called link decay. So something that I've announced recently is a new project that is funded for the CDLI and for the Digital Library Program at UCLA that will take all of our assets and transfer those into the permanent repository of UCLA and therefore of the California Digital Library. That means, finally, that if you don't trust me, or if you don't trust our Berlin partners or others at CDLI, I hope that you can trust enough the longevity of the University of California to deliver the pathways that you can link to at the publications, the monograph, the journals that you might yourself might want to contribute to or even to establish in your respective institutions. Just one quick word about the level of documentation that we have now at CDLI. We have just crossed recently the 200,000 barrier. We've tried to judge roughly how many tablets there are that we are missing, and I think each year those numbers keep growing. That is, unfortunately, it is an expanding universe, and so we look at our solar system and think that we've got quite a lot of material here, but the fact is that as we look at the British Museum and try to get a hold on the numbers of tablets there, or the Istanbul Museum and try to understand how many tablets are there, the disappointment is rather large as we discover that we are missing more and more. Just the same, a collection now just over 216,500 entries of cuneiform is very substantial. I think it is a good seedbed for the kinds of research that can be done with online resources in cuneiform. Much more important than the images, as I say, we have about 84,000 images currently of these tablets, are certainly the transliteration files that reach towards 1.2 million lines of transcription. Those are really the research core of CDLI, and they have only very lightly been exploited in research heretofore. We hope that with greater programming support, we will be able to do more than simply tie our files into Steve Tinney's dictionary in Philadelphia, but we'll be able to add lots more, as I will think I will show in the midst, as I show through here, the kinds of tools we're thinking about doing. Well, so I said we have some scanning targets. Recently, we have been very successful in the past in scanning texts in Berlin and in St. Petersburg. And we are looking to do more work in Britain and in the United States and in Syria in the next several years. But, well, as I said, images are sort of high-impact parts of the project, and they get most of the attention from people in journalism and, I think, in many ways from colleagues. But certainly much more important are the transliterations that we keep of the cuneiform texts. And we have, in fact, devised a means of writing so-called ASCII transliteration format files that we have been trying to push with other Assyriological colleagues, that they use that. The reason being is, first, of course, everyone needs to conventionalize the transliterations that they have if they want to remain in communication with larger projects like CDLI or others. But then above all, if we can but have access to all transliterations, then we can commit ourselves to developing online tools that I think give new search functions to researchers in any specialization that they could only have dreamt of earlier. We might have somebody like Gebhard Zelts, who knows ED3B text better than anyone else on Earth, but it's hard for us to push a wire into his brain and to have access to everything that he knows, so that if we can get him to assist us, as we have actually been successful in doing, to take that material and put that onto web, then let's say that doing that, Gebhard, we expand your brain worldwide. So that should have some good. One other thing with this particular graphic, though, that I wanted to say is that I think Assyriologists also look at the tools that we have and say, where are the paleographies? Where are the sign lists that tell us what's graphically happening to a particular sign through many hundreds of years of use? And, of course, we have a sign list. Everyone will pick up Borger or Labat and so on, and Labat is just okay. Up to the old Babylonian period, we have nothing that we can use to look at all texts in the third millennium. And this, I think, the idea of writing in coordinates that are a part of the archival image of the tablets, and then linking these coordinates to the transliteration, the searchable transliteration files, then, of course, all of the research possibilities are open to you. You will look up, in the case of this particular text, you'll look up the sign for Ud that somebody else had up earlier, the sign for a Jenny goat, and you might want to tell your computer, then show me all the attestations of Ud 5 following from Uruk 4 straight down to the Achaemenid period, and I don't want to just see hand copies. It might be kind of scrappy, but I want to have access, obviously, to the representations of the physical tablet. So I think that is a way of putting together new paleography online that most of us, certainly those of us who have been spending most of our time working on third millennium texts, can only be very happy about. Now, to get to the screen collection, I put this list up to show first that it is an extraordinary new hit of late Uruk texts. There are 417 texts. I don't even have to exclude the so-called Wilson series, though that's not part of that collection. I'm sorry, Mark, that I had that in there. But still, 417 new texts. That was almost unheard of. I must say, when we discovered, through the good services of Horst Steibler, down in Freiburg in Germany, that there was a collection of some 80 archaic texts in the Erlenmeyer the Swiss Ellenmeyer collection. That was a moment of great excitation in Berlin, and we did everything that we could and were in fact finally successful in getting 1 million Deutschmark pledged from the Berlin Senate to purchase the large number of those texts. Now suddenly we're looking at 417. Alone in the screen collection, we're looking at, I think, I forget, David, is it 200 or 120 new ones in the Owen collection and the Cornell collection, and maybe there are another 80 or 100 that are sort of loosely moving around that haven't been able to attach themselves yet to a major collection. I can only say that obviously anyone who looks at material that is coming out of illicit excavations in Mesopotamia knows that you're looking at the cleanest representations of inscriptions that you can hope to find effectively. Those have been sifted, and you are really looking at very high quality things. The other thing about the Skuyen collection is that Martin Skuyen was very high on bringing high impact images collections into his tablets into his collection, and therefore, as you see on the right there, lexical is school exercises, mathematical texts, and particularly literary texts, you see a representation that is almost unheard of if you just take a general sort of non-Abu Salabik type excavation. You will generally hit about 90% administrative texts, and the rest are going to be a mix of these. If you're lucky, these Skuyen has obviously paid much greater attention to getting much higher impact texts. Just to go through a couple of the really high profile texts in the Skuyen collection, I think that most would say that this is the most important text. That is a full copy of the Ur III period law code, now safely ascribed to Ur-Nammu and not to Shulgi, in a cylinder that is missing but very little of it. It's it has got not just all of the legal jewels that we would hope to see in this early law text, but for those of you interested in administrative history, I put up here a couple of sections that deal with wages paid to craftsmen that are well beyond the kinds of wages that we're used to seeing otherwise. Well, now to the lexical text. There are 120 lexical texts in the Skuyen collection, of which 21 are new lexical witnesses to the archaic collection that we've just seen here several times. I put this up because I hadn't been thinking so much about what's going on with these funny colophons on these texts. Of course, these here you have four identified witnesses of the famous Lu list, of the list of professions, with not so very interesting what's happening on the obverse, but I think quite interesting on what's happening on the reverse of these texts. First, with a notation, a numerical notation in the sexagesimal system that has simply counted the numbers of entries in each text, and then a number of signs, be those ideograms or logograms with Jerry Cooper, that we need to better understand. I think that, as we know, the colophons give us a global understanding of a text that you otherwise won't have by looking at the specific entries. Well, I noticed in these four texts that at least in two of them you have a nice set of notation, a nice set of these ideographic type signs that are Sangha Gar Amma that you see there, and the one instance in each case of the sign Nam. Well, that suddenly looks like that is fulfilling our expectations of a text. We just saw that the Diri list is called the Diri list because Diri is the incipit or the first line in that text, and it looks like they were also therefore naming, or we can hypothesize that the archaics were naming their important school texts, these lexical texts, according to the first sign or the most important sign in the first line of those lexical texts. In this case, Nam 2, which might represent some kind of a pedestal or something, and we think it might represent the correspondence to later Nam, namely something that qualifies in abstract sense some kind of office. Now, so to hypothesize that Nam was in these colophons because that was the first sign in each of the texts, then I might have to test it across the other lexical lists and see if it pans out. I, of course, looked around, and they're not so very well preserved, these notations. But in the case, for instance, of the so-called vessels list that was also described here, I would have hoped to have found the sign Ni, which is meant to be some vessel and later represents some kind of oil. Well, in the one text that you see on the left here, that's unfortunately broken, but again with the sign combination Gar and Ama and probably Sangha, but with a nice fragment to the far right that in fact again has the same, what I want to think is the name of a scribe, but also looks like part of the sign Ni. Well, this then we are lucky enough to test against the Uruk lexical list, namely looking at the large text here on the left. You see a much clearer representation of the sign Ni in a text that is again the Bessel's text starting with the sign Ni, so that we can again propose that, not so interesting really, but we can propose that after all the first sign was the designation of the entire list. One other thing I discovered while looking around the Uruk lexical text was one that, or the Uruk text altogether, was one text that was mistakenly published by some errant editor of ATU 7 that, interestingly enough, had the same combination of Gar, Sangha, Ama, and knowing that that is from Uruk, we might therefore suggest that these Korean texts themselves are not from Uma, as has usually been proposed, but that they might have themselves been pilfered from levels at Uruk. Just a couple more things. One more example of a lexical text now in the Skuyan collection. This is another beautiful image done by Jakob Dale in Oslo of the bottom third of a very large geographical list that in fact fits very nicely with the texts that are called Geography 1 and 2 in the publication ATU 3, the lexical text from Uruk. So you see the nice fit there between a cutout of this large Skuyan text and the fragment of one of the texts that is the geography list in Uruk. But even more interesting I find here is the extraordinary size of a mock-up of the entire tablet. Namely that if I simply pull it out to the size that it should have had originally, sorry to go back, then you see that it is about four times the size of the heretofore largest known witness for a lexical list from Uruk. And suddenly we're looking at a text that has the bulk of text that we only started, this text that we only started to see in the much later Fara period. Quite aside from all of the material that we will see here that is of importance for the geographical names in the archaic period. Well, because Henry has mentioned to me his great interest in the origins of the sexagesimal system, I did want to put up one example, and I guess I can dedicate this to you. We'll call that the Henry sign of a new member that we've discovered in the Korean collections, namely a new very large number that is the correspondence to what was later called Shargal in the sequence sexagesimal sequence in Mesopotamia that is just beyond the until then largest known number sign in the Uruk corpus, that is Shar Ufa 36,000. So suddenly things that are registering numbers are 216,000. That has lots of implications. Obviously, we will ask, what are they counting in those numbers, assuming that this is a real notation? And I leave that to speculation, what that might be. I'll leave that to you guys to figure out what that is. There is one other example, though, again, of another sign that we had not had attested in the archaic text until the Scutian collection came along. That is this text of a field with lots of field notations, whereby on the reverse surface of the text we have, again, what looks more or less like the same sign that we had in the sexagesimal notation, but here in a field notation, just to give you a quick idea of the size of the notation. If it fulfills our expectations of the absolute sizes of these notations in the archaic text, that this would suddenly be a notation taken together of an area of 390 square kilometers, and therefore an area that rivals some of the larger provinces of the Ur III period. You see also then at the bottom that is about 15 times the size of, again, the heretofore largest known notation in the entire Ura corpus of 5,500 texts. Well, one last point about Scutian collection before I get, I don't know how much time I've got, but before I get to my slaves that I wanted to say something about, that is that the Scutian collection is also giving us nice information to help in determining the importance of positioning the famous bulle and their enclosed tokens within a chronological series that reaches from loose tokens to enclosed tokens and bulle down to numerical tablets and to pictographic or ideographic tablets in the Uruk 4a period. Namely, the issue that we've always had of having 140 intact bulle in different collections all over the globe, where museum curators refuse to break them open and look inside. Rather, we have lots of these closed bulle that had tokens inside that curators are very fond of shaking so that possible donors are impressed by the rattling that goes on in there. But those of us who are thinking about how the tokens are disintegrating inside are less impressed by the rattling that goes on in there. So the idea, of course, would be to open them in some way, either radiographically by shunting cancer patients to the side and running our things under a tomographic analysis, as has been done both in Heidelberg and in Paris, but also simply do the brutal and the right thing and break them open with a saw or whatever you've got. This is what Scutian did, and I can only compliment him for the work he has done, because he has in one shot doubled the amounts of material available for study of these critical elements in the history of cuneiform writing, doubled what has been otherwise known in the past 150 years of excavations. Those things, then, you can look at them statistically, you can then start to devise new explanations for the ultimate meaning of these important tokens. Well, now to get to my quick point. That is, does the Scutian also offer any new material for understanding this non-ever-ending? I think some members of the panel here have considered it now a closed book, the question of the Sumerian substrate of the earliest writing system. I think I heard something from Jerry that stated that it is a fairly straightforward matter. I think it's a good idea. I think it's obviously we can't say that that's not possible, but I think that it's important to put together the data that we do have and that is cited regularly in any number of publications to prove that the earliest scribes in Mesopotamia were in fact speaking and writing Sumerian. So I just put together what I know. If I forgot something, I'm very grateful if someone can add some few things to this. I have a little color scheme here where those yellow instances I consider to be uninteresting, and I think that the blue instances at the bottom are at the least still interesting, if not convincing or even compelling. To the right, also some indication of what we expect to find. And then also I wanted to put up what is always cited from the Abydos text, that is the instance of two separate tags with signs that are read B3 and ST and are meant to represent the house of the goddess Bastet. So two rather good hits directly in a very small number of texts, and where we have 6,000 texts, we are reduced to very speculative studies of some few instances of sign combinations. Well, so what can Skouyan bring us? I have mentioned that I have spent some time working on administrative texts and archaic texts, and have always thought about the format and what the format tells us. Everyone says format is important in the archaic, it's much more important than in later periods because it supplants some of the function of semantics in the text. But with the format of herding text, as you see the herding text here of a herd of 95 sheep, the format is very specific in dividing those animals into different categories according to age specifically and to gender in the case of pigs that I have chosen in honor of the year of the pig. Here also into categories of where they are going and where they have come from. Well, we were thinking about this when we did our first publication of the Djemdet Nasr text some years ago, when in the so-called slave text from Djemdet Nasr, we found a strict use of cases following numerically qualified cases that corresponded to those numerical notations. This is the most famous text, so that's a nice Djemdet Nasr example of humans that are called Salkur and Sag times Ma, or Salkur and Erem, that is, humans that we would define as female and male slaves of the type Sag Ma, that is, a human with a noose around its neck, and the other called Erem, that is, humans that are on the yoke. That makes good sense, I think, from almost all iconography that we have ever seen. Having that, then I started to look at other instances of Uruk texts, including these, where again we have the same kinds of notations of humans, but always with these interesting cases following them that had just, let's call them ideographic signs, but no numerical signs. Well, then the gates opened for us with the new text that came on the market in the last 10 years. The first was shown me by Philippe Talon. This here is a text that he copied that again has the same notations with the qualifications of these different humans, but again with these subcases after the numerical notations. And I give you here just a quick cutout of what exactly was so interesting. You see that this upper notation, in fact, is counting that suggestion is 17 of the units that are described as all, and that here there are in fact 17 subcases, each one with one or two or three signs that only make sense if those are designations of humans. And we think that designations of human slaves only makes sense if that's true. Well, then more and more of these texts will come out through screen. This is a copy of the same sort of text where we can identify again a very nice set of qualifying terms of what we expect slaves to be called at a higher level, but then also carrying all of these interesting lists of signs that represent persons. Here I'll just run through several examples of the kinds of texts that show the same format, more or less, that is some number, followed by a corresponding number of cases with ideograms and only ideograms. I added these tags because as tags we've seen earlier, and I think tags are also relatively good candidates for this kind of notation of human names. Again, more from the, now from the screen collection of these kinds of texts. I would be putting this up on web and very quickly so that you can then test and make sure that that's true. This gives you then the opportunity to tag all of the presumptive names, put them together, sort them in lists, and start to say, yeah, ask the question, do these names comport in any way to the form of names that we have from later Sumerian tradition, known Sumerian lists? Well, I think if you look at this, you'll say Ain looks rather good, looks like rather an interesting one. It might correspond, for instance, to later use of Ur or of Lugal as a lead element in names, but in no single case do the following elements comport with the kinds of things that we have in names in true Sumerian prosopography. Not one case. Particularly missing is a single attestation of a pantheon name, of some divine name. No single instance of that whatsoever. These, just so you start to decipher, will start to count and then to sort and put up the most important signs. That's what I've done here. And then finally also a list of the important, the most, the best attested signs and sign combinations that do in fact represent humans, that should be personal names as we understand them. And I can tell you that I am very positively disposed towards finding a combination there that would fit what is a very conservative mark of Sumerian civilization, that is the conservative use of personal names. I am very open to finding it, but I personally do not. And I leave then for those of you who think that we are clearly looking at a Sumerian set of scribes to try to do the same. Well, I have just one last slide, and I'll close. Namely, that one of the objections that you might make against this is that these are all just foreign slaves. Of course, they went up into the mountains, they shackled and threw nooses around the necks of these poor mountain folk and brought them down and set them to service. So that you might expect that there's going to be a certain number, maybe most of them will be incomprehensible foreign names, and that therefore we should not expect to find the names of our scribes shared with our scribes here. So I did want to do one quick check of those that are easily identifiable in the Ur III texts and come up with groups that are in the great majority fairly standard Sumerian forms, some that are clearly foreign and some that are Akkadian, as we would expect, but at least a goodly majority of Sumerian forms, so that even if that's the case, even if the Uruk overlords brought down large numbers of foreign slaves, I cannot imagine that they would go from one to the other and say, what's your name? But I think they go from one to the other and say, your name is so-and-so, and I'm going to call you so-and-so, so when I call you, you know to come, because I don't want to try to pronounce your name. So I would be very surprised if we were looking at just foreign names there, but less surprised if we were looking at the names that would have been assigned or carried naturally by a domestic population. Okay, so that's the thing. I think it's a good idea. It's a start for us to start to lemmatize the entire archaic corpus as to those words that we do understand and to isolate those that we do not. Okay, thanks very much.